everyone, and welcome to another episode of Horror Homeroom Conversations. I'm Elizabeth Irwin.
I'm Gwen Hoffman.
I'm Dawn Keatley.
And in today's episode, 1-2 Freddy's Coming for You in Wes Craven's A Nightmare on Elm Street and Chuck Russell's A Nightmare on Elm Street 3 Dream Warriors. In the original 1984 release, a group of teens attempt to outsmart Freddy Krueger, a supernatural killer who stalks them into their dreams. In the 1987 sequel, a band of institutionalized teens attempt to defeat Krueger and save the life of an innocent by intentionally entering Dreamland together, to dire consequences. Aided by one of the most famous monsters in horror film canon, the films are considered essential viewing for fans of the slasher film. But is there more to this franchise than blood and gore? We're breaking it all down today with spoilers, so stay tuned.
And I just have to add that 2024 is the 40th anniversary of Nightmare on Elm Street.
And so for everyone at home who just gasped and now realize that they are old,
yep.
Welcome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what we thought.
So what did you think about this rewatch? Because I know we've all seen this movie.
I absolutely loved watching these over again. They completely held up for me. And I found the excitement that I've been missing. I think just revisiting it, I was like just reminiscing in the kills. And Freddy Krueger is still just as amazing as I had imagined him in my head. Because I was afraid that sometimes when you go back, it's just not what it was. But it was still everything. And it solidified to me that the 80s is the ultimate decade.
Well, on the other hand, I've never been a big fan of this franchise. I much prefer the Halloween and Friday the 13th franchises. I did really enjoy the first Nightmare on Elm Street, going back and watching it again. I was much less of a fan of Dream Warriors. And I think the gore, it's interesting that Evil Dead is playing on the television yeah. screen in Nightmare on Elm Street, because Nightmare on Elm Street is that kind of film that almost verges on slapstick at some point in its gore, in its kills, in its monster. And I guess I prefer the more sort of restrained, subtle horror of Halloween and Friday the 13th. That's my gut response.
That yeah. helps, because I was going to ask what makes you like the others more. So that makes sense.
I mean, I read somebody who said Nightmare on Elm Street really diverged from slashers like Halloween and Friday the 13th because there are none of those stalking point of view shots.
Mm-hmm.
And that is one of my favorite things about slasher movies.
Yeah.
Like the point of view shots that for most of the film, you don't even have a body attached to it. Like
yeah.
the killer is just a moving point of view. I think that's the phrase that Vera Dyke used. But Freddy is just like he's in. You just see him all the time mm-hmm. in grotesque ways. It's a little unrestrained.
And for me, it's that lack of restraint that totally sells it. But okay. I think I'm like Gwen. It's impossible for me to separate this movie from nostalgia mm-hmm. for me, because this was like one of those mainstay sleepover movies.
Yes.
And so when I go back and watch it, it's always going to be sort of couched in sort of that fondness. I did think it was interesting rewatching it this time because I picked up on the POV shots. I think there's maybe one, maybe two, but largely they're absent.
Yeah.
And that was a surprise to me because of how many different ways that this film does push against slasher conventions, but it's still upheld as one of the like preeminent slashers. But it's really much more than that. And I know we're going to definitely get into that.
Yeah.
So what do you think it upholds and doesn't? So we've nailed like the POV.
Right.
It doesn't uphold.
You can go and then I'll go.
Okay. Well, I'm actually going to reference a really excellent article that I read, and it's Razors in the Dreamscape, Revisiting a Nightmare on Elm Street and the Slasher Film. And it's by James Kendrick. And a lot of what he argues, I think, is that the film has a lot of interesting engagement with gender, right? So yes, we know we absolutely have a final girl. And she's a final girl in really the classic sense of the word. But he talks about how identification is such an important part between like the killer and the final girl and how this film challenges it. So one quotation I wanted to share was, "A Nightmare on Elm Street, which makes it difficult, if not possible, to shift identification between Freddy and Nancy because he is inside Nancy's subconscious. He is the inside to her outside, the interiority to her exteriority." And I thought that was such an interesting framing of that relationship, which I think challenges the typical slasher film conventions.
So in a way, that relationship between the killer and the final girl and the victims is just that he's inside them. I mean, that's kind of something that's... I watched Nightmare on Elm Street 2, and that's one thing that Jesse says. He's inside me. So Freddy is like inside the characters, which is a different version of that relationship.
That's and there's also that like really interesting aspect of possession horror that gets introduced, because really Freddy is sort of possessing them via their dreams. And so it kind of moves it from like a straight slasher to this hybrid form that I don't think it gets enough credit for being.
Well, there were definitely references to The Exorcist in both the first one and the third one. I mean, when Tina's killed in the first Nightmare on Elm Street and she's like thrown around the bedroom and her boyfriend, you know, like screaming and doesn't know what's going on. I mean, that seemed like it was right from The Exorcist. And then in three, one of the characters has like the words appear on his torso, just like in The Exorcist, when Reagan kind of manifests "help me" on her stomach. So yeah, it's kind of more of a possession movie than a slasher almost.
But it almost, like your referencing of The Exorcist made me think about how much of this film has gone on to appear in other films.
Yes.
So the most obvious of which is that you start the film and you think your identification is going to be with Tina. And then it quickly shifts to Nancy. And it reminded me so much of Scream, where you think you're starting off with Casey and then it shifts to Sydney. You also have even just the little things like seeing the tricycle reminded me so much of Saw.
And it feels I saw that too. I was like, they stole that tricycle from this film. I had no idea.
Yeah. And it's interesting because this is not a film that I think of as informing a lot of other horror films that came after. And yet when you rewatch them, you're like, you can kind of pick which films correlate with which scenes. Yeah. So I thought that was interesting this go around.
I think that part of what drew me to Freddy and the Nightmare on Elm Street versus maybe Halloween and Friday the 13th is how can you even compete with the idea of something that attacks you in your sleep? Like, that is terrifying.
Yeah, like, it is.
Way to feel helpless, where at least if I'm awake, I feel like I have a chance. And people aren't going to think I'm crazy. Whereas in this case, it's a biological need to fall asleep at some point. What were they saying? The record for going without sleep in one of the films was 11 days.
Right.
And some of them were at 7-8 days. But at some point, you got to give in to a higher power. Like, he's everywhere. That's terrifying.
Well, I actually think that's one of the reasons that I like this franchise less than others. Like, I think in the 80s, I was just more scared by it.
Makes sense.
Like, it is very, like, it's deeply disturbing that you are just completely helpless to this monster when you fall asleep and you can't help but fall asleep.
There's no slow burn.
No.
When it comes to Nightmare on Elm Street, I think I counted it in the first film. It was like by minute 15 when there was buckets of blood.
Yeah.
And the terror had already started in the credits.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a rando girl running through the boiler room, steam coming everywhere, shadows of Freddy Krueger, which was not Robert Englund at the time. It was the stuntman, but just like everywhere. And you just felt surrounded and like, what is going to happen? Is this happening now? And I think that that's what I liked about it, too, is I want to feel that terror right away.
See, I don't. You're reminding me of another reason why I don't like this franchise so much. You're right. Like, the first movie just starts and Tina's being chased in this like cavernous industrial looking site. And I like slow burn films.
Yeah.
Like, absolutely. I like starting in the realistic world, a buildup of dread. I mean, It Follows is one of my favorite sorts of, you know, slasher films. Though there is the, you know, the sort of obligatory opening scene that has someone killed. But it's subtle and restrained.
But that, I like that point, though, because it conflicts really with the monster of the film. So you have Freddy, and Freddy is more cerebral, especially when you compare him against Jason, that's strict physicality.
And never talks.
And doesn't speak.
Right.
Yeah. Or
and
Michael Myers.
So you have
neither
this,
one of them
Yeah,
speak.
Exactly. So you
that's
have this monster who is more cerebral and is clearly thinking, there's a reason that he's targeting these people. This is not accidental.
And he's good at it.
And he's good at it, which contrasts against the film, which just is running on emotion. There isn't a lot of sort of thinking that you do with this film. It's more led by emotion. So it's interesting that there's sort of like that tension.
Absolutely. Even if you think about it with the sheep that's kind of running through the scenes in the beginning, it feels like predator and prey, like through the hallways. You just have this random sheep, which is not really explained, but it's like he separated this one from the flock. He isolated it and he's going after it. And I like that sense of just biological fear response that happens.
And there's enough surrealism introduced in the film that maybe that's sort of the space where people are sort of invited to think a little bit more carefully about what's actually transpiring. But it's just such a cool tension to have, like, those scenes of, you know, the, with the bed and the blood gushing out that is completely visceral set against, you know, the scene with the sheep where you're left wondering. I mean, it feels so, you know, Lynchian in so many ways. Yeah. What does it mean? What's the bigger picture? So it plays with a lot of things that I don't think it gets credit for.
Yeah.
So you talked about the school, and I think the school is kind of a cool thing to talk about because this film is situated largely in schools.
The first one, then the institution, I guess, in the second one.
Yeah, but it is unabashedly about teenagers.
Oh yeah.
Yeah,
so what a better place to have it. So where are you going with that?
But I just think it's kind of telling. I mean, obviously we're looking at films 1 and 3. Yeah. So there is a film 2, but it's a complete outlier. It's an excellent film to talk about, but it's an outlier to like the central story.
Yeah.
It struck me that you have a school setting and then you have an institutional setting, and what that's saying about both spaces and how both spaces treat young people.
Mm. Not that differently.
Not that differently.
Institutional. Yeah, that's what I kept thinking to myself, boy, oh boy, the 80s really were about teens, period.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Teens ruled the world.
Yeah.
Adults were out of touch. You can't talk to them. They're not going to help. So we've got to take matters in our own hands. And then I started to think about other films from that time period. I was like, oh, yeah. And then into the 90s, because you think about the, like, I Know What You Did Last Summers and stuff like that. But I was like, boy, oh, boy, that was the true demographic. And then it made me think, and this is separate of this discussion, do we think that that target demographic has changed based on these slow burn movies? Because I can't see that appealing to your traditional, you know, 17 to 24-year-old male, historically known as the audience for horror. Like, did we all just grow up and we want something different? I don't know.
So, but you don't want something different.
Yeah. No, I don't, but...
You're still stuck in the 80s.
It was just a side question that came to my head. Do I think that horror is really looking at a different audience now? Because you don't see those types of horror
films. That's an interesting question, and I'm sure the answer is yes. I mean, everyone who grew up in the 70s and 80s watching, you know, all of the blockbuster horror movies that sort of proliferated at the movie theaters. I mean, you know, we're all in our 40s and 50s and we still watch horror, but maybe we're open to a different kind of horror.
Yeah.
So there's just like a constantly proliferating market for older people in terms of horror.
I think, too, the issue with the 80s movies is that they really pushed boundaries. And I just don't know that we're in a climate where you could make an 80s film.
Absolutely not. You would be canceled before it was even finished.
I do think the pendulum will swing a little bit so that, you know, you'll start to see more of those type of films. But right now, I just don't see it playing.
Because horror has always been known to push a little bit of boundaries.
But right.
Yeah, I don't think you can make an 80s film today. No.
Yeah.
Not unless it went straight to Tubi.
Yeah. Straight to Tubi.
We love Tubi.
Which I love
we
Tubi.
Do love Tubi.
I love you, Tubi. Yeah. Call me.
But it's funny you bring that up because I just recently watched Freeway, and wow.
I love Freeway.
You need to rewatch it because there's two scenes in there that I was like, wait, what is happening right now? I do not remember this. And yeah. So I don't know what we were drinking in the 80s.
And can we also give a shout out? Because I'm going back to the school in my head, you know, and I want to visit your English classes.
Oh, yeah.
But I also was thinking, yo, how many amazing actors got their start in these Nightmare on Elm Street films?
Yeah.
So just these two alone, you have Lin Shaye.
Yep.
Yeah,
Lin Shaye. A rock star.
I was surprised to see her. I didn't remember.
You had Johnny Depp when he was still American.
Yeah.
And
stop it.
And Lawrence Fishburne.
Yeah. I did not remember Lawrence Fishburne, but I was happy to see
him. That was in number three, the orderly. Yeah. The tech. Yeah.
Oh, okay. I need to look familiar.
But Lin Shaye, yo.
Yeah.
It was good stuff.
Makes me happy.
Well, to get back to the teenagers thing, though, because that's one thing the 80s did, right? Like, movies. I mean, you know, there'd been some films in the 70s, but even horror films in the 70s, I think, incorporated older people. And certainly before that.
Yeah.
The 80s were really the time of teenagers, and it had to be about working parents. I mean, that was the other big thing in the 80s. Like, women really went to work en masse in the 80s. I mean, Gen X is the latchkey kid generation. That's one of their defining traits. So, you know, we have teenagers who are completely alone, oftentimes in their own house. They move between school and house and they're alone. What's interesting about Nightmare on Elm Street is the parents aren't just neglectful, right? There is not,
hedonistic.
No, yeah. It's not that they're just not there.
But what do you mean they did this all for their kids?
Yeah.
But we're going to get there.
But I mean, that's the reiterated major. If you're looking for themes, like, that's the theme of one in three, at least. Yeah. And this is one reason why two is an outlier, because Jesse, the protagonist, is not one of the Nightmare on Elm Street children. But yeah, they're all paying for the parents' sin. I think that's actually kind of articulated directly. Mm-hmm. Nancy says it in three. Mm-hmm. She's like, it's not your fault or mine. It's our parents. They burned him alive, and now we're paying for their sins.
And it matches. Ooh, I mean,
yeah.
It matches sort of the authoritative vibe in Reagan's America. So it makes sense to me that a horror film that's going to be challenging social norms of the time would push back against the parents being the people who, you know, are safety and protection. And showing that to be an illusion. That makes sense to me. It also kind of connects number two a little bit more, too, because that's explicitly gay themed. And that would also be a reaction to sort of the Reagan America of the time.
Yeah. So they're sort of anti-authoritarian films.
Yeah.
Yeah. The parents are like the protective government, and both of them are like messed up. So the teens just have to get out there and kick butt and save themselves.
And it kind of plays into what you were saying about especially mothers going to work en masse.
Yeah.
This whole idea that you're not going to be present, but then you're going to still try to come in and take this control and authority, which would kind of match up with politically ideas that people might have.
It might also explain the posturing of the mother. In number three, you have a mother figure who sashays into the scene.
Kristen's mother,
And this time has like a glass of like bourbon and a cigarette. And she turns and like literally strikes a pose. And it just struck me like how performative the act of motherhood was for her, as opposed to even say Nancy's mother. Nancy's mother she was definitely involved because she does take her to the sleep clinic, but she doesn't do anything I don't think a rational mother would do. Whereas with Kristen's mother, it was so much more of a performance, it felt like.
Agreed.
Well, that scene with Kristen's mother was a direct repetition, I thought, of Tina's mother at the beginning of Nightmare on Elm Street. Like, she also just, like, walks into Tina's bedroom, I guess when Tina's screaming, and says something to her, and then there's a man off screen who's like, you know, come back here or something like that.
I love how she says, you either have to cut your nails or just stop having those dreams.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, mic drop. But it does also really damn the moms.
Yeah,
so
it does.
It's assuming that they're all divorced.
Yeah.
And then because they're divorced, they are hussies who smoke and drink all the time.
Right. And bring strange men into the house.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Absolutely.
And in Nightmare on Elm Street 3, the strange man who is calling to Kristen's mom, when that scene gets repeated later on, it's Freddy who kills the mother. So that suggests that these stray men that the mothers are bringing into the home are dangerous.
But how feckless was the father in the first one? I mean, he's literally a cop who can't protect his child.
Yeah.
Seems to have given all of his parenting choices over to the mom.
Yeah.
And then when she's in a window on the second floor screaming for help, get my father, come back in 10 minutes, get my father. Nothing.
Yeah, she's all right. He had things to do.
It's all right. I mean, I get that there was a whole murder next door, but I don't know. I just sometimes think, like, if my child was screaming from the broken second-story window that's barred, and I see smoke coming out of the house, it may change my course.
One would hope.
Yeah.
But there were strange parenting decisions. Like, I kept thinking about when Nancy is brought to the sleep clinic, and they have scientific data that something is happening. She literally pulls the hat out with her. She's got these bloody scratches on her, and her hair legit has turned a portion of you right. And yet they're like, "Well,
we don't know.
I don't know, man. Like, take her home. Who's going to release this person to go home?"
Mom's like, "Oh, your hair."
Yeah, right. Because that's the important part.
Yeah.
You know, as this gets back to The Exorcist, actually, which I was thinking of when you said that, because. I mean, Chris McNeil in The Exorcist has been criticized for being a working mother. She's definitely not a bad mother. But look at how long she labors over getting her daughter help.
Right.
Whereas by the time we're in the 80s here, it's just like, oh, well.
But I think to it, too.
So sad.
First of all, I also love that sleep clinic equates to mental hospital.
Yes.
But at one point, my jaw definitely, I think, hit the floor. When they were talking in number 3 about suicide, and they were assuming that the one guy killed himself, and maybe we're going to touch on this later, I'm sure we will, and he's like, you know what? He killed himself. I don't care what you're telling me. He killed himself. He failed us. He quit. He lost, and he failed us. And I was like, oh.
That's in number 3, and I have that in my notes. Yeah. The framing of suicide is wild.
Which is crazy because it was in everything. Think about Heathers.
Yes.
And, like, talk about suicide was a big deal, but boy, did they do a bad job of it. Like, I think that was even worse than the portrayal of the mothers.
It definitely was, because it wasn't even just positioned as, like, a personal failing, which would be horrendous enough. It was, you've literally actively done something to other people.
Yeah. It started to remind me of, what was it, like late 60s into 70s, when you started to not be able to trust traditional institutions. Like, you can't trust the police. You can't trust the army. They're not going to be able to come and save us. This was like an attack on parents and professionals, hands down.
But it's so wild to me that that statement is uttered by the one person in the institution who is supposed to be on the side of the young people.
The kids.
And who is, you know, trying to help them go and believes them.
Yeah.
Basically.
Was it the Neil?
Yeah.
Doctor?
He looks like Bill Maher.
And he's...
tricks my head
every
time.
Half of the reason we probably don't like him. But, but when he said that, I was like, this is not... I could have seen that coming from the other doctor.
Yeah.
Who wouldn't believe them at all, because it seemed like sort of that antiquated thinking. But when he said it, I got out my pencil. I was like, I got to write that down. That's bad.
Well, and this is another move toward putting more blame on institutions. Like, I'm thinking in Halloween, right? The people who work at the mental health facility there are just, again, negligent. They let old Michael Myers go and roam around the suburb, Haddonfield. But here, they're just malevolent, especially the female doctor, Sims. I mean, when she was talking about, I wrote this down, dreams, their dreams, like explaining their dreams to them, stemming from moral conflicts and overt sexuality. It's like, what?
Yes. And guilt,
And guilt, I mean, she has no clue. And if they try talking back to her and explaining what's going on, she's like, lock them up in the quiet room. It's like,
true.
What is this, the 19th century?
I mean, 80s America.
Yeah.
Right?
We forget about these parts. But also talking about the mom, I did not remember this, but I thought it was an interesting play with the idea of thing power, that she's the one who keeps his claws.
Yeah.
And so she's really invited this presence into the house. She's the one. So granted, all of the actions of all of the parents when they burn him contributed to it. But to bring it into Nancy's house, like, his glove is literally in the house. And it just made me think about, like, the power we ascribe to different things and how that plays out in horror films.
Interesting, because I see it almost as she is the castrating woman then. Because that is the source of his power, his vitality.
And she's taken them away from him.
And she's taken it and hidden it. And it kind of further portrays her as that bitchy woman. Because that's the other thing.
I like that.
I have this question about gender. my opinion is in these films, it is rigid gender.
Yeah.
Like, it's feminine, masculine.
You have watched the second one, right? Freddy's Revenge?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well,
then, but I just feel like...
It confuses the two a little bit.
I just feel like, in general, Freddy is pretty masculine compared to some of the others.
That's
very
true.
Overtly aggressive, mm-hmm. very predatory, very... And then I would say Nancy is... I don't see... Yes, she's a final girl, but I don't see any of the ambiguity with her.
That's a very good point. And that was one thing I read in an essay by Kyle Christensen, I think. We'll put the essay in the post. But he talks about Nancy as a final girl. And I think it's really interesting that you talk about Freddy as masculine. Mm-hmm. But yeah, he talks about how Nancy is more of a feminist than, say, Laurie Strode or other more gender ambiguous final girls, because she's a final girl who's feminine. She doesn't have to be sort of pulled into kind of masculinity a little bit to be powerful. She's like powerful as a woman.
And she rallies the troops.
Yeah.
In all of the...
And she's active.
Yeah.
Like, doesn't she set traps and all of those sort of
traps.
Things?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Before the Home Alone kid did it.
Yeah.
It's like,
that's true.
Yes. That's cool.
That is true.
Yeah. And she relies on her boyfriend, Johnny Depp, twice, you know, says to him, like, you got to stay awake. You got to wake
Can't
me
count
up.
On him.
And he falls asleep both times.
Or her dad.
Or her dad. So that's when she figures out how to save herself.
Hmm.
Yeah, she really does. She's a really powerful character.
Because you would have a wave of feminism going through, mm-hmm. which would make sense to have somebody like Nancy play that out instead of some of these mothers. So yeah, you definitely see some tension with especially femininity, but they're still all feminine, but you have the domineering bitch versus this forward-thinking, active...
Young person. Yeah, and Kristen is kind of like that too in Dream Warriors.
Mm-hmm.
She has this special power.
Yeah, and Nancy especially, I think, is a good reflection of sort of that suburban white feminism of the 80s that you still had certain expectations with your look. I mean, it was kind of moved away from the 70s where, you know, it was a little bit more free in terms of like physical expression. The 80s really... It does become very feminine, masculine.
Yeah.
And then you see the only spaces that really challenge that were sort of like LGBT mm-hmm. plus spaces. And so it's interesting for Nancy because she does, you know, she's got the makeup on. She's got her hair all coiffed and, you know, the perfect little 80s outfit.
Soft speaking.
Yeah.
Has the boyfriend, so there's no ambiguity there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Doesn't have sex with the boyfriend, so she's still adhering to those type of traditional values. She's still a quote-unquote good girl.
Mm-hmm.
But I wonder what that means for Kristen then, because Kristen doesn't quite occupy the same role as Nancy. And we also get an older Nancy in the second one because she comes back and works with the students. And I kind of feel like even her demeanor and the way she acted kind of like was a step away from that femininity of the original film.
Kristen or Nancy?
Nancy.
In her professional
mm-hmm.
outfit.
Yeah. And just her challenging of authority reads a little bit differently than it does in the first one.
She didn't challenge it as much as I would have wanted.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she should have been... I wanted her to be more outspoken, but, you know.
Did feel a little demure, like, flirtatious with the other doctor. Her medicines fall on the floor. She's like, oops, oh, I'm sorry. Could you help me with that? You know, I'd be like, yo, get up out of my space, man. Like, stop looking at my stuff. You know, she's not as assertive.
Yeah.
But it's the love interest aspects.
Yeah.
That bother me, because not only, you know, is this in a professional setting with a doctor and like you have medication and he's seeing you have medication.
But were they trying to set her up as the authority in a number of ways? So she's the authority as the final girl, but also now she's a professional and kind of an authority in that professional world.
I think they set her up as an authority on Freddy, but they don't set her up as an authority in the professional world.
Not in the beginning.
If that makes sense.
Because he was like, why is everybody getting so excited about this grad student? You know, so at first he's very dismissive.
It's just
trust
a grad student.
She was a grad student, right?
She was.
Yeah.
She was.
Oh, that explains a lot.
<Ba-dum-bum>. But maybe that's why she still is the feminine authority, too, mm-hmm. versus... I think.
Because the feminine role, it seems like in 3, was taken by the girl who winds up in the TV. Felt like it to me.
Really?
But even those roles weren't very rigid, yeah. I didn't think.
Yeah. She was trying to go be the actress. You see Zsa Zsa Gabor on the TV right. as like a doubling, literally, when she smashes her face into it. But you love how I giggle when that happens. I'm like, yes.
That's totally normal.
But yeah, I could see. Yeah.
Yeah.
What did you guys think of the extra backstory that Freddy got in Dream Warriors with the story? Like, there's this creepy, and this seems completely detached from the rest of the plot. There's this strange, mysterious nun floating around in some scenes that for some reason only the male doctor, Neil, can see, right? Like, Nancy never seems to see her or talk to her. And I don't understand that choice. Like, why couldn't Nancy talk to the nun?
Especially given the nun's backstory. It would make more sense for her to talk to another woman than it would a man, I would think.
I do get it, but I mean, if you think about traditional religious, you know, hierarchy, I mean, granted, yeah, lots of things may happen in some of those institutes, but you still might report to your patriarchal person. I don't know.
I still don't know why. Yeah. But anyway, he sees this nun, and near the end of the film, does she tell him the story? Yes, she does.
Yes.
Yeah, she tells the male doctor, Neil, and again, don't know why him, that a girl was left in the hospital for the criminally insane by accident, was repeatedly raped by the inmates. Her name was Amanda Krueger.
Mm-hmm.
And her son was Freddy Krueger. And this nun was Amanda Krueger, I guess. Kind of floating around after her death to tell her story to this male doctor for some reason. I guess I can't get past that. It just seems wrong. She should have told Nancy. So yeah, Freddy has this backstory. He was the child of a rape victim.
A mass rape victim.
Yeah, mass rape, clearly very traumatized.
And what do we make of it with the nun being a symbol of religion is the one saying that this demon seed must be purged. Does that not feel a little bit Planned Parenthood-y coming from a nun? So that's an interesting conflict to have.
Freddie's backstory in general is really interesting to me because it brings up sort of that nature versus nurture argument, right? So in the third film, we get the Amanda backstory, which seems to be signaling that, you know, he was just quote unquote born bad. But
he was, she called him the bastard son of 100 maniacs.
Yeah. That
big
puts a fine
nature.
Point on it.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. But then in future series, he is adopted by Mr. Underwood, who's played by Alice Cooper, which is perfect.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. But that seems to signal that it's a horribly abusive situation, seems to signal that it's more of a nurture kind of thing. And so it's interesting to me that we see this like weird evolution of Freddy's character. Like, he occupies both spaces, and it's such a developed backstory for a monster, especially if you compare it against like Jason. Or if you compare it against even Michael Myers, who has a bit more of a backstory.
Yeah, I feel like in the evolution of slasher monsters, there's always some point in the franchise where the monster gets the he was abused as a child background.
That's true. Yeah.
I mean, in Rob Zombie's Halloween, they give that to Michael Myers. I have to admit, I haven't seen all of the 15 or so Friday the 13th, so I don't know if Jason ever gets the abused child backstory. So these monsters, they start out as sort of born bad, almost demonic, but then at some point they get the abusive child backstory.
But I think Freddy is interesting because of how he changed over the course of the series, because we were talking about that earlier.
Yeah.
In the first movie, like, he's Fred. He speaks, but he's not, you know, sort of dropping these witticisms. You know, he's just sort of all about business. As the films go on, he becomes funnier. He becomes more sarcastic. And it kind of correlates to what was happening to the character in terms of a pop culture reception, right? So do you remember him being on like MTV?
Absolutely. He was everywhere.
He was everywhere. And it's this very strange time in American popular culture where we're taking a monster. I mean, in his acts, the reason he was killed are truly monstrous, yeah. right? And suddenly he's becoming a pop culture icon where you're wearing him on your shirts and you have the posters and everyone's like, Freddy's the coolest. Mm-hmm. And I've always wondered, why is it Freddy? Why is it not Nancy? Why are the final girls or the people who survive the ones who get that reception? Why is it always the monsters?
And merchandising.
Merchandising, but I think it goes deeper than that. I mean,
there is something to, like, I have a Halloween t-shirt that has Michael Myers on it, not Laurie Strode.
Yeah, and all the Scream merchandise, you're going to get Ghostface. You know, and it's why, and I understand that for a lot of people, the monsters become sort of a fallen for other things, and they think of them in, you know, bigger concepts. But especially for Freddy, like, we know he's a child molester, and we know he's a child killer. And the 2010 remake actually goes really into this and shows him to be, like, way more violent than the original film. Hmm. And so I'm just wondering, like, of all the things
to glorify,
to be,
it's like wearing, like, a Beat It t-shirt these days.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So people cancel that, but not this. And why not celebrate the winners? And I guess maybe it's, again, who's your target audience? Mm. And what are they looking to get out of horror films? Because I don't, for as much as I love my final girls, Jamie Lee Curtis, by far the best one, mm-hmm. I don't ever go into the film actually saying, I want to overcome.
Oh, see,
I instantly walk in looking to identify with the killer, and I'm like, I want everybody to die.
I always go in looking to identify with the final girl. That's fascinating.
Yeah, me too.
And I mean, really? In fairness,
so,
like,
you're the weird one.
That's, no, this
I think
is mind
people
blown.
Are like, Gwen, like, honestly.
This is one of these moments. I'm going to go on a tangent.
Oh, boy.
So we were playing that game Heads Up not too long ago with our family over the holidays. And, you know, the category was candy. And I'm supposed to give them all the words without saying the words and get them to say the candy. And the category was pixie sticks. And I was like, oh, my God, the things that every kid snorted when they were in middle school. Silence. So apparently I'm learning that my experience was very different than most. So this is just adding.
Just confirmation.
Yeah.
Well, that's fantastic, number one.
Yeah.
But two, like, in fairness to Freddy, like, especially in the 2010 remake, the role of surrealism might complicate that. So I think there is some doubt put on whether or not these memories of, and again, this is in the 2010 remake, if the memories of the children are accurate memories or not. So, I mean, I guess there is a space where some people could say this Freddy was actually accused but was innocent.
Oh, yeah.
Which would tie into the 80s and sort of...
Oh, yeah. Satanic panic.
You
know, but the larger overarching question to me has always been, like, why is it always the killer and the murderers that get the merchandising deals and not the final girls?
See, I guess for me, if you always go in for the final girl, you are always chased, which then could make me understand why people like, you know, maybe somebody like Dawn wouldn't enjoy these films, because you're spending your whole time being chased.
Right.
Whereas me, I'm doing the chasing. And I think that, especially for a woman, there's space to identify with, mm-hmm. again, you know, yeah, he had to be traditionally masculine, but to be the chaser and have fun doing it.
Yeah.
You know, because then it's not a stressful film.
I guess it's the elevation of Freddy in particular is sort of like the fun monster. And, like, there were all those videos of him, like, smirking and like making jokes on MTV.
Tipping his hat.
What? That set him apart from, like, Jason, who I actually think of as a much more sympathetic monster. So I don't know. But it's something that bothers me.
Agreed. He was, definitely more sympathetic.
I think I missed the Freddy Krueger MTV videos. I mean, I was in right when MTV started, probably by the late 80s. I wasn't watching it anymore. So maybe that's when...
See, I was on my couch with a glass of Tang being like, this is awesome.
I feel like, but again, I was searching for it. Like, my world was consumed with horror when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when my good girlfriends had Teen Beat, I had Fangoria.
Yeah.
I wanted to save up my money to get a good Halloween mask, because a good Halloween mask cost a lot of money. And when other kids were trying to sneak into the part of Spencer's with the candle that looked like a penis, I was like, I want to find the Freddy Krueger knives.
Mm-hmm.
And that was always my, so I probably would have noticed it. So I was looking for it.
Spencer's. Oh, yes. I haven't had that in a long time.
Yeah, that was a big deal, man.
I assume they're all closed now.
No.
Oh, really? They Mm-mm. still have them?
Yeah.
I guess I just don't go to malls anymore.
Nope,
see,
either.
I was across the mall in the Daltons looking for the Sweet Valley High books. So we had different trajectories.
But I ended up in the same place.
Yes,
though.
Yes. And I do remember, like, for sleepovers, you would go to the video store,
yeah.
and the big thing was like, oh man, you got to see what Freddie does in this one.
Yeah.
So it was talked about even back then as being specifically about Freddie and your engagement with Freddie. It wasn't like, oh wow, like Nancy totally overcomes this.
Yeah.
Stuff. It
yeah,
was like true. Freddie goes ham and like yeah. takes them all out, and it's funny as hell doing it. So. That's what built us.
Oh, no. Well, so just to go back quickly to this, what you said, the 2010 sort of reboot does, which is question whether Freddie actually killed those kids back in the 80s. I mean, I don't think either one or three really questions that.
No.
But Mm-mm. but it should have, because that was, you know, the McMartin preschool thing where kids and parents were making accusations about other adults molesting their children.
Yeah.
Pretty much all unfounded.
Mm-hmm.
But we just, there's no reason to not believe that. As bad as the parents are, we at least believe that Freddie did what he did. Well, he says he did what he did, right? I mean, and we see him do what he did.
Well, you see the souls of the children that he's consumed.
Yeah, that's yeah. Right.
Number three, isn't it?
Yeah.
That you see. So I don't think it was shying away from that.
No.
Huh, interesting.
Although not for nothing, but in three, when she's running with the girl who's so clearly a doll.
A doll.
It might be one of my all-time favorite moments of horror films because that is clearly a doll. The 80s.
But yeah, it was almost like saying the monsters are real. Like,
yeah.
The satanic panic was happening for a reason.
Yeah.
So now, all right. Do you like that one?
The 2010?
Yeah.
Well, I only watched half of it because I actually didn't even think of watching it until today. So I did on my lunch break. But it's a different take on Freddy.
And it's not Robert Englund.
It's not Robert Englund.
I can't get past
it's
that.
It's a very serious
Freddy. I can't
Freddy.
Get past it.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's
I
not
see
him,
that.
And he's too serious. It's literally nothing like Freddy. So I struggled with it.
I remember liking it, which probably
tracks.
For the same reasons, because he was serious.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, it's a much more like postmodern horror film in that, you know, you're really thinking through these accusations, and you're also thinking through, like, what if these accusations are not actual recovered memories and what that means for both parties.
I think that speaks more to the time period, too, because realistically, I mean, did anybody really feel this compulsion to forgive Freddie? Because I think everybody already just liked him in the first place. Like, I don't understand why they went there.
I think because, I mean, it's only really sort of recently that people have started taking horror films seriously and thinking through, like, the messaging. And it's not to say that messaging hasn't always been there, because of course it has, but it's a different environment. I think when you make a horror film now, you know it's going to be, quote unquote, red.
Yeah.
And in the 80s, you were thinking more like, what are the special effects going to look like? Because that was the era of special effects.
Yeah. And it was strictly going out to the mall crowd.
Yes.
Yeah. Or the crowd who were getting the videos to watch at sleepovers. Now there's a more cerebral audience for horror movies now.
And it's not so much, there's a great book called Blood Money, and I can't remember the author, but I will
definitely. Richard Newell.
Yes, yes.
Newell.
And I will link to it. And it talks about, especially in the 80s, sort of how horror films were designed to be sequels and to sort of keep that cash cow going. And so I think that's the early film is a good example of that.
But isn't it interesting that when they tried to recover Freddy, wasn't that the last film then? Didn't everything literally die after that 2010?
After 2010?
I think so.
I think that was it.
That was
well,
the
I don't think it
franchise.
Hit the way they were hoping it would
oh,
hit
absolutely
at
not.
All. Because people wanted to see Robert Englund. Like, that's Freddy.
And it's a spectacle. Because don't you just sometimes want to gawk at Freddy? There's just something about his grotesqueness that you can't turn away from. And I think that when sometimes they muted that, I don't know, he just wasn't as glorious.
As glorious.
There's just something spectacular about him. I don't know. Whoever came up with that character as a whole. Boy, oh boy, man.
Well, Wes Craven.
Well, no,
wasn't
just
it?
Not that. I mean, like, the physical manifestation of it, like who did the makeup.
Oh, okay.
And everything
well,
like
and
that.
And also Robert Englund himself.
Yeah.
Obviously. Mm-hmm. I mean, him and Wes Craven and, yeah, the special effects makeup people.
Whom, according to Amazon Prime trivia.
Oh, boy.
He didn't even want Robert Englund to be his Freddy Krueger.
Did it say who he wanted?
I can't remember.
Oh.
Yeah. That's a nice that you can like hit up on the button and it'll give you like trivia.
Yeah. I like that.
I was like, oh my God, you didn't want him? He's gold.
So many horror films will have scenes of a classroom, specifically English classrooms, where they're diving into literature. And there's a lot of classroom horror. There's Monster on Campus, Halloween, H2O, the original Halloween, Teen Wolf, Hereditary, It Follows, Fortress, Slaughter High, The Faculty, it goes on and on and on. And we have this here, too. And I mean, I think one reason it has it is because it allows sort of an information dump to be done in sort of a clever way and draws parallels between, you know, this traditional literature versus what's happening in the film. Mm-hmm. And I think it's kind of a cool way to engage with like the whole idea of highbrow and lowbrow, because obviously horror films are considered to be lowbrow and English literature is considered to be a highbrow. And the mixing of those I've always found very interesting because it's a very subtle but I think effective way of pushing back on how we sort of privilege certain narratives over other narratives. But part of that too, I think, is the introduction of sort of the absurdism and the urban legends. Those all come into play with the literature that's being taught in the classroom. And so I was wondering if you guys had any thoughts about the classroom, the role of urban legend, any of that good stuff.
Well, I mean, I love the classroom stuff since I am in English. Yes. And this was very highbrow in that we have in a short, like less than 2 minute scene, Hamlet and Julius Caesar. Mm-hmm. And actually, in terms of your question of nature versus nurture, I mean, the discussion of Hamlet is all about nature. According to Shakespeare, there was something operating in nature. Perhaps inside human nature itself, that was rotten, a canker. And then Julius Caesar on dreams. It does seem to be almost a self-conscious attempt to kind of elevate the film to a sort of, you know, we're addressing philosophical issues. I mean, in It Follows, the teacher is reading T.S. Eliot's love song of J. Alfred Prufrock, pretty highbrow. Again, in a sort of lowbrow film.
Do you think maybe that was a choice of Wes Craven? Because, you know, he's also the one who gave us Last House on the Left, which was ripped apart by critics as just being this, like, exploitation, horrible film that has no redeeming value. When in reality, I mean, it was a very specific film to talk about the culture of the 1970s and Vietnam and, you know, threat of danger. I mean, there was a real subtext to it. And so I almost wondered if this wasn't his answer to it, to say, this is more than you think it is.
Yeah.
And this is the lineage that I'm kind of pulling from.
Totally.
See, now my head is going somewhere with that statement from Shakespeare about what does she say before a canker?
There was something operating in nature, perhaps inside human nature itself, that was rotten.
Because that, I get that it's supposed to point us at Freddy Krueger, but it almost points me at toxic masculinity, which I know masculinity was a huge deal in the 80s. That's
absolutely.
We've got Rambo and, you know, all that stuff. But I think about it because part of the toxicity was the rape of Amanda Krueger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Freddy, obviously. And then even, too, you have these traditional males that are ineffective and then killed. So a lot of the toxic Johnny Bravo types are really, is that the nature that started all this? And
that's
then
the rotten human nature.
Yeah, because when you say rotten human nature,
that
makes it sound like not just one guy.
Right.
Yeah, yeah, I think you're
onto something. It makes me think of biological drives.
Yeah.
So if you think about the death drive and, you know, the life drive, they tend to fall under one of two categories, masculine or feminine.
Right.
In many, you know, representations. So what is it saying? I don't know. Because none of this would have happened if it wasn't for the origin story.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which is
related to
100.
And yeah, I get it.
Rapists.
They were criminally insane, but we also, look, let's be honest. I mean, people used to be in psych hospitals for being epileptic, too. So they were still fell under that same category of a hospital. But yeah, these men used a gang mentality, and it was horrific.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's a manifestation of that.
I mean, this gets back to what you were saying about how gendered the film is.
Yeah.
Like, demarcated. And the men and masculinity definitely seem to be the monstrous, whereas the women aren't. They're the heroes. I mean, in Dream Warriors.
The moms.
Yeah, that complicates it, as does the boys in the Dream Warriors film, who are sort of, you know, part of the group who are trying to defeat Freddy.
Yeah, because the third film definitely moves it away from being an individual final person to being a collective.
Yeah, collective, yeah.
Which is an interesting shift, honestly.
Yeah, and it's a collective of girls and boys.
Mm-hmm.
But so, I also love that it's kind
girls.
Of led by the girls.
Yeah, yeah. By the girls.
Deep thoughts.
I think it's good we ended with Shakespeare.
Yes.
It gives us some credibility.
We read Shakespeare as well.
We may even read a play and talk about it for next time.
Let's not get crazy.
So are we missing out on any of the literature? Because I know you guys have read up a lot, and you said that there's really a lot written on that. And that actually seemed to surprise you guys.
There's an interesting article. I'll link to it. It's called The Boogeyman of Your Nightmares, Freddy Krueger's Folkloric Roots, that I thought was super interesting. And it talks about Freddy occupying that space of boogeyman and historically what that has looked like. So I will definitely link to that. I thought that was interesting. But I always think of Halloween as the film that's the horror film of that time that's been the most written about. But I was shocked at how much I was finding about this particular film.
Yeah.
So there's a lot out there. And I'll link to some of the more interesting articles.
That's interesting.
You read the Wikipedia page?
No. I edited the Wikipedia page. No. To fit my
needs. My hero.
But it is, because you do reference the boogeyman in like Halloween.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But Freddy actually better aligns with him. Because if you think about the boogeyman in general, you think about him getting you at night. He's hiding in your closet.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
It's bedtime.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's much more of, and that's kind of what that article does. It sort of sets Freddy up as the archetypal boogeyman. Yeah, that's a cool essay.
Yeah. Well, we would love to hear what you think about Freddy. Do you agree with Gwen that you are in it for Freddy, or do you agree with us that we are in it for the final girls? Or are you somewhere in between? Let us know. You can find us on social media at X and Facebook. Those are the ones you want to go to right now, because I'm not getting up on the Instagram.
Just get snail mail. Mail us.
You we'll can put snail mail Gwen and myself.
I love letters.
Dawn is out there doing the work of five people and making social media.
Far more capable than all of us.
1,000%. But we will be back. Well, we hope you enjoyed this episode, and we will be back next month with another episode. Who knows what it'll be? It's a surprise to us as well. But in the meantime, take care and thanks for listening. Bye.
Bye.